It all seemed so easy once. Reject austerity, get Brexit done, and level up Britain. These were the big ideas that won Boris Johnson his thumping majority. But this was already a stretch for some Conservative MPs. Didn't they come into politics to make the state smaller, not bigger? And now, suddenly, the state is more essential, more critical to the lifeblood of our economy and health system than ever before. The state, in other words, is back. So what happens to those economic libertarians now? Today we ask, is Toryism changing for good?
Let's make 2020 about the people of this country.
That's why we need to make sure that we have real change at this election.
Making this country the greatest place in the world to live.
This hasn't been the year Johnson hoped or expected. Gone is the rip-roaring optimism.
This has been a disaster, right? Let's not mince our words. I mean, this has been an absolute nightmare for the country. The country's gone through a profound shock.
This is going to be hard. Our economy is going to take a significant hit.
We are back with a Fox News alert. We have just learned this. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has tested positive for the coronavirus.
Hard practical politics and tough decisions are the orders of the day. Not exactly his specialty. On this Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper, and my co-host Zoe Williams, we ponder the future of Britain's Tories. Are they changing? Is there a strangely Corbynite new economic consensus? And what can we learn from the international picture about Britain's future? Joining us to get a handle on it all is journalist and author Paul Mason. His latest book, Clear Bright Future, includes a discussion of the nature of the new authoritarian right. We'll be asking him where the Tories fit in. And Christabel Cooper, a data scientist and Labour councillor, she's the co-author, with me actually, of Devastating Defeat. This is a report we wrote after the general election 2019 to get a handle on the changing nature of the UK political divide. You can find a link to it in the podcast description. To feed back to us on the show, you can contact us on podcast@anothereurope.org. An extended version of this podcast is available to paid-up members of Another Europe. In this week's Extra Time, we ask, how can we build the resistance to Toryism? To join and support our work, go to anothereurope.org/join. It's cheap as chips and makes a big difference.
Let's start with the international picture first, to put the Tories and Brexit Britain in context. You've described a kleptocratic state, so a state where corruption is rampant and systematic, as a kind of natural evolution for capitalism in the 21st century. Can you tell us why?
I don't think it's natural, but I think it's logical, because we'll use the N word, neoliberalism. As an economic model, it's in crisis. We're seeing stagnation across the developed world, Japan 250% of debt to GDP, America heading that way. And so what I think happened in the middle of the last decade is that a section of the neoliberal establishment in several countries decided to keep neoliberalism without globalization. So they go, okay, we need to deregulate further, we need to double down on privatization, etc. But now, instead of regarding the world as a kind of collective cookie jar through which the financial markets allow you to dip in and take what you can, now we're all going to scramble for our own piece of the pie, to change the metaphor. So Trump, I see as a nationalist neoliberal. I see Orban the same. I see Jair Bolsonaro the same. It's Thatcherism in one country. So once they decide to do that, a new alignment has to emerge, and it has emerged in most countries. In Britain, we saw the rise of UKIP, and then basically the Tories become UKIP. They drop their liberal wing. The rise of Cameron. I covered the adoption of Cameron as the Tory leader, and I remember what a huge hope Conservatives at the time had that they would evolve into a kind of liberal Democratic Party. They've gone the different way. And what's happening to the GOP in America is even more stark. They are now for a ruling party of a state that relies on the rule of law and constitution to keep capitalism honest. We are seeing the Republican Party basically rubber stamp one corrupt and authoritarian decision after another by Trump. So I think it has economic roots. I think it has a root in the failure of neoliberalism as a global system and the need for those who want to keep it going to defend it behind national borders.
Why would that mean it had to be corrupt? Could it not just be, you know, because I'm thinking specifically about the unfolding of this conservative regime and, you know, Genrikh being the first scandal of the kind of the past month. Why does authoritarianism have to be corrupt? Is it just its impunity or is there something else?
Capitalism itself is organised corruption. If you look at Britain, the specific thing that, you know, I'm not using the word corruption, by the way, here, but the specific thing that Genrikh and Desmond were discussing is how to get around a perfectly reasonable rule that says if you build luxury speculative accommodation, you also have to build some social accommodation or pay a lot of money. Section 106, it's called, you know, where you have to build some social housing in every development, was actually a Labour thing. And it was being, let's put it frankly, taken the piss out of under Labour, under John Prescott. The opportunity that a switch to neoliberal nationalism provides is that suddenly globalisation was a rules-based order. Even if what was happening was that one major country was trying to impose its rules on the others by making those rules multilateral. So you think about TRIPS, you know, America imposing intellectual property rights on Europe through an international agreement. Now it's in a different way. And I think that what's interesting is the way in which, I mean, both in Britain and America, you've got this fraction of the bourgeoisie. I'm old enough to remember when we had a debate about fractions of the bourgeoisie, the city versus industry in the 1960s and 70s. I think now, this is what I write in my book, Clear Bright Future, we've now got a new fractional division within the British and American elites. You've got people who need the rule of law, they need stock market valuations, they need that whole open capitalism, open market capitalism, to thrive. And then what was Trump's social base? Casino owners. Trump has done a lot of business over the years with trade unions and contractors in New York that are heavily aligned with organized crime. So the casino owners, the construction bosses, these were the first people who actually backed Trump in the middle of 2015, before anybody else backed him. They backed somebody who would disrupt the rule of law and multilateralism and the kind of level playing field and actually start giving contracts and money and favours to their chosen people. And I think we're seeing a pale reflection of that so far with Johnson. But remember, he's hardly started. He's only been in power properly for 8 or 9 months. And then you've had the COVID thing disrupt him. I think that in the next 2 years, we'll see Johnson move just as far down the route of business favouritism. You could argue that's what is already happening with Palantir. Palantir getting this contract to provide what they call a single source of truth to the government on the coronavirus, with no record of it being able to do it in the past.
I agree with a lot of that, and I was fascinated by the discussion in Clear Bright Future of Peter Thiel, the founder of PayPal, where I think he's no longer with the company, but you discuss how he came out about, I think it's in the last decade, and said, well, look, we're not going to be able to sustain democracy with economic liberalism and with economic freedom. So in a way, this is neoliberalism because it harks back to a pre-democratic form of liberalism, right? Like the 19th century, if we don't have universal suffrage, liberals saw democracy as a endangering economic liberty, and that was their great fear about the working classes like coming, you know, taking over. On the other hand, it does seem to me and like it's a big break from neoliberalism in the following respect. Basically, capitalism in this century has become hugely dependent on the state, and that's true since 2008, but it's even more true in the coronavirus crisis of 2020 that we'll talk about in a second. And that does, it seem to me, mark a quite big structural shift from what Margaret Thatcher was doing, in the sense that okay, the state was always critical to bringing about neoliberalism. It was always the state that was carrying through the privatisations. But the scale of the subsidy and the bailout of the private sector now does sort of completely undermine this idea that we're living in a system that you could call the liberal free market, where the market is rational and the market left to its own devices will get on with it, what it does, and then we'll all be fine. That assumption just doesn't seem to hold anymore. So in that sense, we're in a post-neoliberal time, right?
I think it's an interesting point that the relationship between state and business is then antithetical to this idea of complete free market efficiency that I think that we thought that Thatcher had brought us to. And certainly you're right with first with the bailout of the banks and then now with coronavirus, you are seeing the fact that business cannot survive without the state. And that, you know, does lead to sort of these kind of slightly murky, I guess, connections, potential for these murky connections to start emerging. So yeah, definitely, I think there's the potential for that to happen. And certainly sort of, I guess, for a pure Thatcherite, and I think we'll come on to this later, these are rather nightmarish times because this is not what they bought into. There is a genuine belief that markets deliver efficiency and that they deliver fairness, and that government interference in whatever way, whether in a kind of well-meaning left way or in a sort of Trumpian corrupt way, either way, these, you know, a true Thatcherite, a true neoliberal, if you want to use that word, would look on in horror at these kind of relationships between the state and business, I think.
But do you think there's a sense in which we're looking at it through yesterday's glasses? Because we're talking about, you know, a Thatcherite small state versus a kind of post-COVID huge state, and it is huge. But actually what Paul's talking about and what a lot of people are talking about is really a gangster state in which it's not so much either spending a little or spending a lot on the public good, so much as extracting from the public good. And that, I wonder whether we've faced that kind of bluntly enough.
What I think is interesting, though, is that a lot of Tories would not want that. This is not what they signed up for either. So I think it's an interesting, it's not just a sort of that we on the left are criticising this. I think that there'll be considerable criticism amongst the Tory party as well. I think we'll come on to the splits and the tensions within that.
I have a broader definition of neoliberalism. I love William Davis's pithy definition, which is the disenchantment of politics by economics. A more elaborate one he offers is that neoliberalism basically is the coercive imposition of market norms of behaviour by the state. Now, if you think that, I think you can then see that it can survive both austere fiscal regimes and expansive fiscal regimes. Because after all, while Thatcher was slashing public spending, Reagan wasn't. Reagan and Paul Volcker in the early 80s administered the same shock that Thatcherism did through monetary policy, through interest rates. So we in Britain have a particularly austere form of neoliberalism. And I think that for me, neoliberalism is a kind of long economic model that's taken different forms. I think we're heading toward the end of it because you can have a big state neoliberalism in the sense of big borrowing and big money printing. I would argue Japan as part of the neoliberal system. It's a mercantilist component. So is Germany. But, you know, these are not small states. The issue is whether or not you think that there is any prospect of fiscal and monetary discipline going forward. That, I think, is the head fuck for modern mainstream conservatism. Because even when it's borrowing and spending, as in America, to buy its way to the next election, even when it's borrowing and spending as Osborne had to do, you know, before they were implementing austerity for those few months, what they're thinking is we'll pay it all back. We'll pay it all down. We'll erode the debt through growth. This is the myth they tell each other. But one of my contentions in post-capitalism, and I've become more and more convinced of this, is there is no future value. There is no bright, sunny upland where debts at 150% of GDP get whittled down to 75%. At the moment, the Bank of England owns about a quarter of all Britain's debt. I think it will go higher. It will never go lower, not in my lifetime anyway. Now, the point about this is all of these things are not in liberal theory. And so you've got this situation where, again, to quote Will Davis, I think he writes brilliantly on this, it's become literally unjustified. It can't justify itself to itself. Actually, if we're talking about the psychological and political confusion of conservatism, is because they, I think, because they can't make a straight argument from the facts, i.e. huge debts, huge monetary stimulus, to the theory of neoliberalism has mutated towards nationality, ethnicity, cultural warfare. Late neoliberalism has to talk about something else other than the economy, because the economy story is so disrupted by the facts.
There is something concrete about coronavirus that people can see the raw results of incompetence. And this is certainly true in America. And I think it's true here that people who previously were like, had had enough of expert and didn't care about cause and effect are seeing cause and effect and not liking it. Do you think there's a kind of real world political effect that arrests those more conceptual directions because people just have enough? They look at what they've got and they've just had enough of it.
I'm afraid I don't. I think that what Trump has done and what Bolsonaro has done and Putin and Viktor Orban is consolidated an electoral base for whom no amount of truth matters. So once you construct the frame that the enemy is a series of others, you know, the other, it's Antifa at the moment, it's China or it's migrants. What you've done is you've solidified a base. Now, this is not fascism, but it is authoritarian right-wing conservatism, nationalism. That you've consolidated a base that will accept anything. Support for Hitler got stronger as the Third Reich collapsed and was invaded by the Red Army. Just seeing, you know, 100,000 Americans die needlessly isn't going to convince any of Trump's supporters that he's wrong. What is interesting, however, and I think this has happened more about racism than it, i.e. Black Lives Matter, than it has around COVID, is that we are now seeing for the first time, and this makes me really glad, actual big capital in America taking a side against Trump. And it's taken a side on BLM. And it's taken such a level of a side that we've got something like 90 major companies in America pulling advertising from Facebook because they've become a platform for the far right. That, I think, is the good thing. And I think we'll see the same corporations, the same professional class who lead them, look at the coronavirus and say, we're in America, we're the worst in the world. In Britain, we're the worst in Europe. What's going on, guys? I haven't met a bourgeois in Britain who defends what Johnson has achieved over COVID-19. But that's not the same as their mass base falling apart. They're not.
The liberal capital break around Black Lives Matter seems hugely significant and is balance line driven in a generational way, because they're seeing, look, young people and this generation of young people in the West despise racism in a quite historically different way, I think, to previous generations. And this will be a huge problem for us as profit driven organisations going forward. So we have to move, and we have to move decisively. But I totally agree on Trumpism and what that says about the Republican Party too. And to link back to something, to the comparison with Reagan just for a moment, is that yes, you know, Reagan was like a big spending neoliberal, absolutely, but that was always very controversial within the Republican Party at the time. This was a Republican Party that was really committed to the balanced budget constitutional amendment, not formally as a party, but it had a lot of support, the idea that America should always run balanced budgets. And that reached its peak in 1992, I think, in US conservatism with the Ross Perot campaign in the presidential election, not Republican Party, but very conservative and leading on the balanced budget. Today, well, what does this Republican Party look like? I mean, I'm afraid one of the two ruling parties of the US political establishment has moved overwhelmingly and in a dramatic way towards racist, white nationalist, authoritarian nationalism. And while there's lots of positive signs in the polls right now around how well Biden is doing, Trump might well lose the presidential election, let's hope so. It's a complete calamity what is happening in the United States. Looking longer term, it's a scary phenomenon, because one of the main parties of the US elite, which will be in power again in the future, has moved dramatically towards the far right, I think, in quite a profound way.
I was just going to be slightly more optimistic about the judgment that the electorate will bring, hopefully at least, on Trump over his handling of the coronavirus. I do think that coronavirus does pose a big problem for some of these populist regimes, because you're right in what populist regimes do when inevitably their policies fail and their incompetence is revealed is to blame someone else. And, you know, Paul is absolutely right. You know, it's China, it's Antifa. You can reach for a handy anti-Semitic conspiracy theory if that suits you as well. But I think the problem that they have with coronavirus is this is a microscopic organism. It doesn't have a face. It doesn't have a kind of, there's no visceral body that you can attach it to, that you can kind of create that idea of antagonism to. So I think, you know, Trump, when he calls it the China virus or the Wuhan virus, he's definitely trying to put that face to it. He's trying to put a specifically Chinese face to it because populists need enemies. But I think coronavirus is hard for them to do that with because it's an organism. And the other thing with it is that because every single country in the world is facing exactly the same problem, it's very difficult to evade those kind of international comparisons. It's very obvious that, you know, even if coronavirus was manufactured in a lab, in a secret lab in Wuhan, the fact is that the Germans and the Danes and the South Koreans and the New Zealanders just have dealt with this an awful lot better than America and indeed Britain have done. So I agree with you that if Trump loses, it will probably be because he has been deemed incompetent rather than people have balked at his racism and his nationalism, which means that those issues continue and they will continue for the Republican Party. But I do think just simply on the competence front, I think this is a profound problem for some of those corrupt and incompetent populist regimes.
On the progressive side, we made a lot of mistakes during the referendum and the subsequent battles in thinking that when you pointed out the kind of rational consequence of things, that people would buy it and then we'd win, and that was wrong. But I wonder whether we're making the same mistake again, in a way that we're kind of making an appeal. We're seeing an organism as part of our toolkit in exactly the same way, when it just isn't.
The political problem for the left is that I think it's already there in Britain that, I mean, it's been suspended by COVID, but not for long, because let's say the unspoken thing about Leicester and Bradford. What my comrades in Leicester, in the left, are saying is it's all over Facebook that Leicester is locked down because Asian people are spreading coronavirus. That's what's happening. It's not been reported on TV because, quite rightly, the broadcasters are trying to suppress it. But everything is framed as culture war. We went on the doorstep in Plymouth during the election, and Plymouth's 25% of everybody in Plymouth only has an emergency GP access. There's not enough GPs. So as a result, the A&Es are overflowing with people who should be seeing their GP. And you turn up on the doorstep and you could predict from like moment one, second one, what the reaction was going to be. And it shocked a lot of Labour activists. Some people said, yeah, how terrible that the Tories have cut the NHS. But a lot of people said, yeah, how terrible, the wrong people are turning up to A&E. And you say, what do you mean? They say, the migrants. And then you say, well, who else? They said, time wasters. What they mean by time wasters is all the people they see on benefit porn shows on Channel 4 being demeaned and belittled in the benefit system. So the thing is that I don't think the British left has quite understood that that is the now, that is there. The values, as Paula Surridge makes this point in her research on the British Electoral Survey, values are determining everything. Now, until we get our heads around that and try and sort of not mourn the demise of everything being about economics, but actually deal with this as a political challenge, we're not going to get anywhere. And I'm confident that we can defeat Trump. I'm not yet confident that we can defeat Johnson, because Johnson hasn't really even revved up into the use of this cultural warfare and perpetual crisis. He's also an incompetent politician. Trump's got some competent people around him. But I don't know what the rest of you think. For me, that is the defining thing about politics right now, the inability to break out of the values and cultural framing, no matter what the issue is.
Paul's right in the sense is that I think the left has had trouble accepting the fact that the median voter is quite socially conservative. Around half the country genuinely want to bring back the death penalty, for example. And I don't think, certainly in general, we've moved more towards having more liberal values. I mean, you sort of take something like attitudes towards homosexuality. We've gone from 1967, it was legalised, through to Section 28. That obviously went in 1997. And now we have equal marriage. And most people have broadly accepted that. And when you think of that kind of journey that we've had, it's kind of quite clear that, you know, according to nearly all measures, whether it's, you know, sort of whether you'd be happy with your son or daughter marrying someone of an opposite race, we are becoming more and more liberal. And part of that is to do with education. There's a very strong link between social liberalism and holding a degree. And of course, because of the expansion of higher education, there are more graduates in the population. However, I would also say that whilst these cultural, social values are becoming increasingly important, and they were very much the very big determinant of the Leave vote in the referendum, there is still a place for that left-right divide. So I think, to go back to Paula Surridge, she's more or less saying that at the general election, that left-right divide and the social liberal conservative split were equally important. Now, that's not been the case before. Previously, it was like if you were left-wing, you voted Labour. If you were right-wing, you voted Tory. And now it's a much more complex situation. But that left-right divide is still important. And I think that does then spell quite a lot of trouble for the Tories, because at the last election, they picked up quite a lot of disaffected Labour voters, many of whom, interestingly, still identify with the Labour Party, but who, at least in that election, either because of Jeremy Corbyn or because of Brexit, chose to vote Tory. And a lot of those people do have quite left-wing views. They do believe that the government should be doing more to redistribute income. They do believe that big business is taking advantage of people. But they voted Tory. And you can see there was some recent research from UK in a Changing Europe, which showed that there is now quite a disconnect between the views on that left-right axis of Tory MPs and the people that voted for them. So I think that that is going to cause some significant problems for the party.
So when it comes to the Tories, a lot of attention has been put on Dominic Cummings, and rightly so. Even before Johnson took the decision to stand by him over Durham Gate, he was the most powerful special advisor in Number 10 Downing Street. His views on Brexit were always part of a wider populist project, and he barely disguises his hostility to the civil service and the judiciary and, of course, the BBC. But Paul, do you think his project has anything in it beyond this kind of splenetic unpleasantness? And if so, where is it heading?
We mentioned Peter Thiel before, and Cummings comes from this new technocratic, anti-libertarian group. Okay, Cummings represents a worldview that everything that's wrong with capitalism can be solved by better technocratic outcomes. So if you look at what he's trying to do to the civil service, I mean, the civil service is sclerotic. Under neoliberalism, the marketization of the machinery of government is why it doesn't work. And the civil servants, I've reported so many times at the Public Accounts Committee, seen them sitting there basically defending dysfunctions because the market demands the dysfunction. That's become almost like the article of faith of the civil service. So Johnson and Cummings, they want a machine that works because the machine needs to tear apart large parts of what's left of the welfare state, of British civil society. They want a permanent crisis. They couldn't cope with the COVID crisis. It won't cope with a no-deal Brexit either. So they've kind of declared war on the civil service. But what they then find is that, bad as it is and inefficient as it is, there isn't a technocratic solution to it. You can see this with something that the left doesn't really talk about a lot, but they are quite obsessed with, which is defence. So they started, they say, came into power, and Johnson said, we're going to have the most fundamental defence review we've ever had. OK, good. You need one because the world's changed. China and America are at odds with each other. We're in COVID, Russia, etc. And we've left Europe. So they set out on it. And then in mid-March, they realise, shit, we can't do this. We actually can't do it. We haven't got the expertise. You know, Cummings and his weirdos and his 20-somethings, they run into what? The securocracy. the securocracy of all the generals and ex-generals and spies and diplomats, they say, well, you know, you can't just do it from a kind of three books you read that were written in Silicon Valley. You've got to take account of the fact that we do have a defense industry, that it does work in this way. So they run in to the immovable obstacle of the British bourgeoisie. And I think the fact that they've done that once, they also then ran into the health bureaucracy. They couldn't make it work. No lever they pulled worked. It came off in our hands, they kept saying. So now they keep talking about move fast and break things. That's been, in a way, neoliberalism's philosophy for 30 years. But the problem is, having broken it, they have no solution. And my hunch is that Cummings will get bored with this, that he's already got his eyes on working for Trump administration too. And they're utopian right-wingers. Like a lot of utopians, when confronted with the need to actually do work with existing systems, they give up. And I kind of hope he does, because the guy is a malign presence. And just like Trump, he's showing what you can do when you're prepared to break with constitutional conventions.
It's funny that they keep talking about the Public Health England and the NHS as a sign of civil service dysfunction, because, of course, the whole infrastructure institutionally was created in the Lansley reforms and passed by David Cameron's government in 2012, right? And there is a pattern of decision making that stretches through, I'm afraid, the last Labour government and Cameron's administration and what we could call the neoliberal paradigm. And it's creating incredibly arcane and complicated bureaucracies, which are not very good at talking to one another. And the Lansley reforms in the NHS were a clear sign of that. Now, it is interesting, and again, maybe this is why Cummings is something different, because he comes along and he says, well, look, I don't like this way of doing things and we need a different way of doing things. And there was this evidence he gave to the Select Committee during the Brexit referendum in 2016, where he attacks bureaucrats basically and says the Anglo-American model, and I think he's really thinking about the American model here, is good because, you know, it's been flexible, it gets things done, it can respond to change, he says.
Do you have a system in which you can correct errors quickly, learn from things fast, adjust, which has been one of the great strengths of the Anglo-American system over 200 years, or do you have a system in which bureaucrats and a judicial system entrench ideas in a bureaucracy which is extremely slow to move, change, adjust, adapt?
Really? Like a US political system that is so difficult to pass anything that it's never really been able to agree a health reform that anyone was satisfied with, right? It's so complicated. But I think what he means by it, though, is a bit more malign and dangerous than that. He means that the American political institutions are extremely responsive to corporate interests. And I think this is the danger of his attack on the civil service in the end. It's we're going to embrace the rentier corporate interests as much as possible and have as little public oversight, public authority. And this is why his constitutional review and everything, I mean, it does have this slightly nasty direction to it.
To me, it seems that Cummings wants to run government as if it were Amazon or Google, one of these big multinational tech companies. And I think that, you know, his obsession with technology is to do with the kind of technology, that kind of very responsive AI, which, you know, customers change something and immediately the algorithms will change. It will immediately shift to doing something different and responsive. So I think, you know, the phrase kind of move fast and break things is a very corporate one, and it works in a corporate environment where the consequences of moving fast and breaking something is, oh, you might lose, you know, a few hundred thousand dollars worth of sales, rather than, oh my God, 60,000 people are dead. So I think Paul's right. I think eventually he'll get bored because government is not like Amazon, it's not like Google. And he resists the accountability, democratic accountability, just as a CEO barely has to answer to shareholders actually anymore. So I think he embraces that model. But what he's obsessed by, I think, is he wants government to deliver to voters as if they are consumers what they want. And I think he's actually fairly agnostic about what it is he delivers, just as Amazon is fairly agnostic about what it delivers. But he wants to do it quickly, he wants to do it efficiently, he wants to use lots of fancy algorithms and weirdo data scientists to do it. And of course, that runs up against, as you both say, the civil service, which simply doesn't do things like that and actually wants to use genuine expertise as opposed to a bunch of algorithms to do it. But I think partly why he rubs the Conservative Party up the wrong way is that he's prepared to deliver to the public whatever it is they want, and he doesn't really care what that is. And so you see at the last election, the public seemed to want, you know, some fairly left-sounding things like levelling up. They wanted a fair bit of big government. And so that's what Johnson promised. Now, I don't think that before the coronavirus crisis, any of us thought they would actually deliver it. But I think even the fact that that was what was promised was a reflection of Dominic Cummings being very, very flexible about what it is he delivers to people. He doesn't care. He just treats the voters as if they are consumers.
I suppose my anxiety is that when you describe him like that, he sounds like he's got a coherent plan and we might not agree with it. And there will be losers, but there will also be some winners. Whereas actually, the way I see it unfolding is more that there is no coherent plan and the creative destruction creates nothing, and they're very, very happy with complete destructiveness. And that I see more in Brexit and I suppose latterly with COVID, that the worst possible case scenario is never too bad for them. And this, I think, goes back to your work, Paul, about the you know, those major American funders, the Koch brothers, Peter Thiel, actively seeking to create terrible outcomes. And that's the bit which sounds like a lefty conspiracy theory, but it's also the bit which I find most plausible.
What I wrote in the book is that when Thiel wrote that essay in 2009 for the Cato Institute, what he's really doing is inadvertently recreating the thought architecture of fascism. You know, to say democracy and freedom are no longer compatible because, you know, he actually says in part because where women have the vote, he clarified it later, but the American right and their British counterparts, so not the CDU in Germany, not Macron, not the French Republican Party, but the American right and its Anglo-Saxon counterparts in Australia, Canada and the UK have a very different and much more radically right-wing view of the world. It is Nietzschean. That's the other thing about it. It has that Nietzschean, you know, I'll shoot you in the face and run away laughing if I can, because that's what they believe. And it comes from Silicon Valley is the new fountainhead of it. And the old fountainhead of it is all the casino bosses who supported Trump and the property developers and the Ayn Randian Nietzschean obsessives. That's what it is. That's what we're dealing with. And we need to realize that for them, the world is rules free. For them, it's obligation free. They're just going to do this until we stop them. My fear is that they're going to use the machinery of the state precisely to empower the far right everywhere. Trump's already doing it. Trump's America, whether by design or accident, is losing the state monopoly of armed force. You know, you see these things that the woman gets out of her car and waves a gun in the face of a black guy. The husband loses his job. She's arrested. But so many times that doesn't happen. That program is all driven by the American right, and it is coming to Britain and to Europe.
Behind all of the hipster language that Cummings uses, I think there is actually quite a worked out and very right-wing politics along the lines you described.
I think it's right-wing because, like Paul says, it doesn't have any rules. I think rules are what he utterly despises. It's what he disliked about the EU. It's the fact that you could be restricted as to what you do. I am slightly less convinced that he's got a political right-wing agenda or so much of a political right-wing agenda behind that. I think he just wants to not have rules. I think he just wants to, if he chooses to suddenly embrace socialism, not that I think that that's at all likely, he is allowed to do that. But it's just, he just does not want any constraints on him. So he doesn't want the EU telling him what to do. He doesn't want the civil service telling him what to do. He doesn't want the judiciary telling him what to do. I'm not trying to underplay the danger of that. And like I say, tens of thousands of people have literally died as a result of not having a decent framework, not having accountability. So I'm not trying to underplay the fact that this is a monumentally dangerous man or that what he's trying to achieve is dangerous because, you know, rules are there for a very good reason.
If you look at his blog discussions and his obsession with the German Kaiser and stuff, I think there's a little bit more going on than just a sort of opposition to rules, in the sense that he's attracted, in quite philosophical but nonetheless Trumpian terms, to leaders that have sovereignty and do what they want. So it's kind of antithetical to democracy in that respect, right?
I would agree with you with that. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. He doesn't want accountability, doesn't want scrutiny, doesn't want any of these things. No, absolutely not.
That concludes the podcast for those listening on the podcast platforms. The podcast was produced in collaboration with the Friedrich Herbert Stiftung. For more information on their work on building progressive dialogues between the UK and Germany, go to fes-london.org. If you want to know how the discussion ends, you can access additional material by joining the Another Europe is Possible campaign. Members of Another Europe help keep the show on the road, even in these difficult times. To join, go to anothereurope.org/join. In this week's Extra Time, we ask Paul and Christabel how we can mobilise opposition to the authoritarian drift, what will a successful challenge to the Tories look like, and what do we make of Annalise Dodds' first speech as Shadow Chancellor. You're now moving into Extra Time. Thanks for supporting Another Europe is Possible.
When it comes to the resistance, it seems like there are two things that are in some ways in a bit of tension. Electorally defeating the Tories and changing the narrative in Britain by promoting a completely different set of values. You've seen these tensions play out, for example, with the Labour leadership and Keir especially wanting to seem tough on law and order and on the side of Black Lives Matter at the same time. Who thinks which bit of the left is going to win and why?
So on Black Lives Matter, I, along with a whole load of people, watched that footage of the statue of Edward Colston being thrown into the harbour in Bristol. And, you know, personally, my heart leapt. I thought it was a wonderful moment. And when I looked at my Twitter timeline, you know, I'd say about 80% of it agreed with me. Next day, you get the YouGov polling, and it turns out that 13%, actually thought that Colston should have been thrown into the river, and just about over 50% thought he should have been removed and put in a museum. And then, you know, very sadly, you've got a 30% of people that think that it's fine to have a statue of a mass murderer in your local town square. But there you go. So we've got to be aware that the values and the views that we have on the left are often at odds with that median voter who is verging towards the socially conservative. But on the other hand, when you look at sort of, you know, what is the BLM movement about? Ultimately, it's not about, you know, Keir's right, it's not about statues. It is about ending structural racism. And I think broadly, most people in this country don't actually want to live in a racist country. They don't think of themselves as racist, and they recognise that racism is counterproductive. You know, if you're discriminating against people, you know, you're not allowing people to reach their full potential because of the colour of their skin, that doesn't actually benefit anybody. So I think that I would be pretty supportive of the stance that Keir's taken, because he's trying, you know, I think John Denham, I know possibly not somebody who we want to mention here, but I think he said you can disagree with the voters. You don't have to agree with everything with the voters, but you don't have to disagree with them on everything. And I think it's about sort of trying to not pick fights over things that we don't need to pick them on and that we're going to lose on, whilst keeping in mind what we really want as the main thrust, which is, you know, why hasn't the Lammy report been implemented? Why haven't all those other commissions reports that have been commissioned over the last 10 years been implemented? Let's do that, and let's focus less on some of these issues that very clearly the Tories are trying to create a culture war over in order to split what is basically a majority of British people that don't like racism, that don't want to live in a racist country. And, you know, I think that could be brought on board with a plan to end structural racism.
The problem with the way the left is dealing with the cultural values divide is one set of people don't want to acknowledge it. Chantal Mouffe, you know, following Lenin, following Gramsci, calls this economism. The idea that the economics predominate and that, you know, it's the same in Middlesbrough as it is in Tower Hamlets, so just forget about your differences. I think that left is in a minority. Good, because I don't agree with them. But the level of analysis that If you read, for example, Claire Ainslie's book, which is a good book called The New Working Class, Ainslie is now Starmer's chief policy advisor. So her explanation is drawn from the Great British Class Survey. And this says, well, you know, the new working class are multi-ethnic, they are precarious, they don't define themselves through work. And then there's the traditional working class, 14% of the population, ex-industrial, low educated, they have different values. Keir Milburn, the left-wing author, said something very interesting just this week about that. He said, the values are not what explains things, it's the values that have to be explained. Now, if you trace the values that both groups actually hold to, so I'm talking about a black family here in Lambeth, where I live, or a white family in Lee, where I come from, it is family, work, decency, and fairness. And I think the problem the left has is when it hears those words, it hears blue labour. It hears conservatism. But those values, actually, to me, are not values. I hear them as a kind of survival mechanism under neoliberalism. You know, hard work because we are the workers, you know, and the bosses don't work. They just sit there doing nothing. Or, you know, fairness because even if you can't fight for a pay rise, you can fight for a fair pay for you. And then family, you know, with the welfare state collapsing, family is the only thing most people have got left. Now, I think the task of the left in the next 5 years is to take those working class people from both sides of the cultural divide from a strategy of survival to a strategy of resistance. But here's the controversial thing. I don't want to go down the route of blue labour. I certainly don't think we can do it only by defending progressive, you know, social values. So what do? I think we have to adopt something I'm calling strong neutrality. We have to make the party a venue where workers of both sides of the cultural divide can have a discussion without somebody shouting them down. That's going to be really hard. And I actually think that's what lies behind when Starmer says, let's not be factional. I think his ultimate aim is to make it beyond so that I don't shout at people who write for Tribune. It's that people who didn't vote for us can come to the party with their grievances and not be called racist.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that, actually. When we talk about unity in the Labour Party, we're often talking about distinct factions, which, you know, even I don't understand often which factions we're talking about or what they're called. But really, if you want to talk about unity, there has to be somewhere where people can go and say things and not immediately be cancelled. And I don't want to lay all this on young people because I think old people are the worst. But there is something in that kind of vehemence of putting a foot wrong when you actually didn't even realise you were using the wrong word, which the right has never had that.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I mean, in the projects we've been doing at the LSE, we always find in places like, you know, Mansfield, that the feeling of not being listened to is a very strong component of the grievances of small town, low growth, middle of the road. I won't say economically deprived, because there's more deprivation in Lambeth, as you know, in inner city areas, but actually middle of the road, economically stagnant, small town Britain that hasn't found a place for itself in the post-industrial economy. The feeling of being quote unquote left behind, not being listened to, really important. And I like the idea of strong neutrality, forums where people can discuss and feel like they're being listened to and are listened to, and the Labour Party's role in doing that is fantastic. I mean, my only cynical scepticism is that that's very difficult to do, because in some ways these are just completely different, you know, life worlds. Even what the Labour Party looks like in a place like Lee or Mansfield is very different to what the Labour Party looks like where I live, you know, in Emily Thornberry's constituency, Islington South. Could I ask you both what you think about the Annalise Dodds speech today? Because that seems really positive.
I think it's good that we've now had two reiterations from the Starmer leadership that we're going to go on a radical economic programme. The problem is you can't spell it out yet because you don't know what the conditions are going to be in 2024. I think it's good that we've seen Annalise Dodds go for wealth taxes. Explaining them to people is going to be hard because they've rejected them at every election we've proposed them. But I'm a dissenter here with Labour, because I think until Labour says we will borrow, we will print money because we can, borrowing is cheap and printing money is almost risk-free, we're not going to be able to explain how to finance the Green New Deal. You can't finance the Green New Deal, let alone a £500 billion recovery programme, which is what we're going to need in Britain, out of taxation. The only bit of taxation that I am super keen on is shutting down the offshore finance system. There's £30 trillion sitting out there. £50 billion is what Labour was talking about raising from the UK in 2017. I don't think much more than £50 billion can be raised through taxation. But by forcing the big companies all onshore, using COVID as the rationale, because now they're benefiting from this social collaborative intervention by states, I think would be a historic thing. And I want to see Labour start talking about that.
Yeah, I agree. And one of the things that we've talked about on a few podcasts with Anne Pettifor and others is that the message that we should be investing in assets to make up the liabilities that the state accrues during this crisis is a really important one and doesn't actually require you to be that specific, right? What you're establishing is a principle of economic governance that you're trying to say, look, the state has run up massive debts and the state should be making positive investments in the economy to offset those debts. Now, you've seen little bits of this from Ed Miliband. I think his interventions around, you know, the government's policy in industries like steel, for example, where it's just announced something. Miliband has been arguing that we should be doing debt for equity swaps, right? If the state is going to lend a lot of money, the state should be taking assets to offset that liability. So that's good. But I think there is a more general argument that needs to be made. And I think it would be popular with a lot of people, right? Which is to say, and I think you can make it in a way that resonates and makes sense to a lot of people, is that the state should be making profitable investments in our housing sector, in renewable technology that will make money for the taxpayer. I think a lot of people would understand that intuitively, and it breaks with, you know, the terrible analogy that you've always had with Toryism since Margaret Thatcher, you know, the state as, you know, the family is the analogy and every housewife knows that you shouldn't live beyond your means and stuff. Whereas actually if the following Mariana Mazzucato and others, if the Labour Party were saying, well, actually the better analogy is the state as a business, right? So the businesses need debt and businesses invest and we want to manage your portfolio, the taxpayer, and we're going to invest in these sectors. And that seems like a big leap, certainly from where Labour was 5 years ago. But even in the Corbyn years, I don't think that they were very good at getting that across at all, because public ownership was always presented as a moral question that was about not being profiteers, whereas actually you could message it in a quite different way, which is this is about the interests of taxpayers. And if you do that, I think it would have much more support in this socially conservative country that we live in.
I think that there are very few good things about the coronavirus crisis, and I'm quite pessimistic about where it's going. But I do think that it has killed once and for all that analogy of the government as a household. I mean, I think it's completely undermined the entire thesis of the Osborne-Cameron austerity regime. The Tories are going to find it very, very hard now to ever use that phrase magic money tree to throw at Labour. So I think it does now open up a whole load of possibilities, because the public have seen the government spending these extraordinary sums of money and the sky has not fallen in. We haven't turned into Venezuela. We're not carrying around £10 notes in baskets to go and buy our shopping. So I think that fear that the Tories managed to create over all those years of like, oh gosh, if you let Labour loose with the borrowing, literally something absolutely terrible will happen. We'll be in the Weimar Republic. I think that that's gone. I think that that has really released a huge amount of possibilities, because, you know, it's released people from that fear that they had been created for so long.